Hi. Hi. Thanks
great
for having
to be
me.
Here.
Chris Anderson, there used to be a time when lots of people like tinkered in their garages and they futzed around with their cars and maybe they had a workshop behind the house. You've said that you think that era is coming back and that we're witnessing a new industrial revolution. Is that really true? I mean, you see this as a new industrial revolution?
I do. I mean, first of all, you know, people have been tinkering forever, and there's nothing different about that except for that they're now tinkering together. You know, the web means that all of our work is now essentially instinctively shared. We build on other people's work. We don't have to, you know, reinvent the wheel every time. And this means that anytime you get people working solo and move them together, they become more productive and they can start to move up and go from tinkerer to more. At the same time, we've had the web's innovation model. We've had a bunch of enabling tools, 3D printers, you know, a software that makes it easy to work. Companies like Adafruit that make it very easy for people to get sophisticated electronics that anybody can use. And you put the two together and you end up with things like Kickstarter, this kind of explosion of entrepreneurship and innovation, which turns into companies, products, and a new kind of industry.
Lemoore Fried, for somebody who's heard the word maker, but they really have no idea what it is, it's kind of tossed around a lot. What is it, and why are people suddenly designing their own stuff?
That's a very good question. So the word maker, which came from Make Magazine, which is a magazine that is you know, quarterly and is available, you know, in any store right now, and you can pick it up. It actually gives you a very good idea of the kind of maker landscape, as you would say. But makers are basically anyone who are creative and they're interested in technology and they're interested in using the new technologies that are available to create devices and projects and products around them. And it's basically taking the kind of skills that we would associate with science, technology, engineering, and math, the STEM fields, and using those as a sort of art form to create, you know, products and projects. So most people, anyone who's kind of like hacked together something or writes code or does electronics or is a roboticist or, you know, doing first robotics in stores or has a drone and has modified it, all these people are part of the maker landscape.
But, you know, we have also seen this for decades. I mean, you think back to Steve Wozniak fiddling around and trying to create that Apple computer. It's nothing really new that people who are into tech or into ham radio or anything try to put things together. So what's different now about, you know, is that this is not just a tiny slice of people?
That's right.
Let me actually take a stab at that. Well, just because Lemoore is an actual engineer and I'm not.
Yeah.
So the difference is that, you know, Steve Wozniak was a genius. And, you know, the skills and luck and hard work required to do what he did back then were pretty rare. I'm not an engineer, and now I run a drone company. That's only possible because the tools have gotten so easy that even regular people can do it. So what Lemoore's doing and her company's doing, they're essentially, you know, providing, you know, they're making it so that anybody can be a Steve Wozniak without having to be an engineer.
Chris Anderson, let me follow up on that for a minute. What role does 3D printing play in this? I mean, a lot of people have heard of 3D printing. You know, I've passed stores now that have 3D printers in the window, sort of printing out little plastic models. What role does 3D printing play in this?
I think there's two obvious roles now, and maybe a third one later. One is just that it allows you to go from idea to prototype really easily. So we have an entire generation who's pretty good at putting things on screens, you know, typing and drawing, and even the generation playing video games understands that, you know, how 3D environments can exist on a 2D screen. And the tools are getting really easy, like Minecraft is a perfect example of the ability to build a world in 3D. What a 3D printer allows you to do is to press a button and actually hold it in your hand. From idea to prototype used to be super hard. It used to require machine skills and you know, expensive equipment. And now it really is no more complicated than a regular paper printer you'd have on your desktop. So that's the first step. The second step is that it is, I think, an educational tool. My kids have grown up with 3D printers, and as a result, digital design is just something they do for fun. This stuff used to require, you know, 4-year college degrees, $6,000 a seat license for CAD software. You know, it was an architectural tool. And now it's the kind of thing that's showing up in in schools as just part of the computer curriculum. Digital design is now like PowerPoint and word processing is something that kids learn. And that's the fact that they can hold in their hand, I think is what has such impact for them. So that's going to create the next generation of inventors and, you know, the ability to take the creativity that we brought to the web on screens and then take that to the physical world is what really excites me.
Lamour Fried, Chris Anderson talks about this sort of changing the life of kids right now. So if you take somebody who's 10 and you think about where their parents and their grandparents got things, they got their stuff in large part at places like Walmart and Target and IKEA, you know, sort of places where everything pretty much looks the same. Is there some kind of movement away from the big box sort of one size fits all made in China movement going on here?
I think that the people who, especially people who do identify as makers, they see all the stuff that you can buy at Walmart or Target or Amazon as just materials that they can use for their project. It's very common to take off-the-shelf stuff, like especially IKEA, which has a huge maker and hacker community around it, and then modify it by either like 3D printing extra pieces to make it more useful or adapt to, you know, your home, or painting or modeling or whatever, using the technology that they have available to them to kind of hack the world and improve it and make it customized for their own needs.
Do you see this draining power away from mainstream companies, either the Walmarts or like the Procter & Gambles, that basically, you know, it used to be that if you wanted a product, somebody somewhere would say, well, these are sort of the products that are available to you if you're interested in a toy for your kids or these kinds of pots and pans or this kind of gadget. Here's what's available. You choose from what we give you. And you're saying, no, now people are able to make their own stuff. So does this drain power away from, let's say, the Procters & Gambles of the world?
I don't think it's taking away a piece of the pie. I think it's making the pie much bigger. There's always going to be a need for pots and pans that, you know, maybe you don't want to smelt your own. But there are needs that are not being met by these big companies. And Chris Anderson talked about it in his book called The Long Tail. There are many, many people who have needs that are not met by these big companies because they're just not part of the, you know, the mainstream, perhaps, or they don't fit into one of the buckets the marketing companies for these big companies come up with. So, yeah, absolutely. The maker movement is part of that. It's part of, you know, this handmade customization, doing what you need, not just going and buying whatever Procter & Gamble came up with.
You know, I would expand the definition of maker to include crafting. I mean, if you're cooking in the kitchen, you're making. If you're gardening, you're making. Anytime you're using your hands to make something because you enjoy it or because you want something unique or you just you just get more value out of that sort of act of participation, I think you're making. And increasingly, all these communities are doing it together. So the crafting community, for example, like if you go to Etsy, that is, you know, that's the long tail of crafting. And, you know, those are people who are working together and reaching customers and sharing ideas with other enthusiasts. And even though they're not necessarily using digital tools, I think it's all part of the same thing.
Yes, but I wonder what the limits are on how big this can get, because the reason most people buy convenience foods or, you know, get a lamp from Target instead of making it themselves is because they don't have time to make their own food or knit their own socks or, you know, make their own lamp. They're working very hard. Americans tend to work a lot. And so they're looking for somebody to make it for them. And I'm wondering, does this change that equation in any way?
Yeah, in most of our lives, we're very happy. You know, there's things we care about and things we don't. Like, you know, when it comes to spoons, I'm very happy to buy them from IKEA. When it comes to food, you know, when some people would rather cook their own. They value that that element. When it comes, you know, in when it, you know, came to, you know, getting a hutch for the guinea pig, I just decided that I was that would be a fun project to do with kids, and I did it myself. And so I think that, you know, we now have the rise of artisanal stuff, artisanal foods, artisanal coffees, artisanal chocolates, boutique clothing, vintage clothing. I think more and more in our lives, we have a choice between the mass and the micro, between the stuff that, you know, the one size fits all and the one size fits me. And of course, we're going to, you know, like, you know, there are limited hours in the day, and we're going to choose the mass for many parts of our life. But each one of us, I think, has one part in our life, if not more, where we really do want something unique, custom, and possibly even something that we've had a hand in making. And now we have the chance to do that.
But Chris, let me just go back to you for a second. You talked about this being the next industrial revolution, and the industrial revolution was something that changed everybody's lives. Is the maker movement going to change everybody's lives, or just the people who choose to pickle their own cucumbers and, you know, make their own hardware?
Well, I think we have two historical analogies. First of all, we had the personal computer, which put computers on every desktop. Remember, you know, the computers used to be mainframes, just like factories used to be big industrial parks that you couldn't get into. Then we all got one on our desktop, and that changed our lives. Then the web, you know, media, broadcast, you know, print used to be, again, big industrial conglomerates. And then all of a sudden, we all got the ability to publish and to broadcast. And so in the digital world, first with computers and then with the web, we saw the democratization of the technology create an explosion of creativity and participation, which changed our worlds. Today, we're just doing the same thing with the physical world. We're just taking the web and computers and bringing it to the world around us of physical things. And, you know, if history is any guide, anytime you give the means of production to everybody, it changes the world.
The view I have, which is it's a little bit different, is I feel like these tools and these technologies that are part of this maker movement, they actually not only do they empower individual people, people who want to make their own rabbit hutches or cook foods or, you know, make their own MP3 players. I think also they really strongly empower entrepreneurs, people who want to start their own companies, especially if they want to do any kind of manufacturing. Doing manufacturing even 30 years ago was extremely, extremely difficult and very, very expensive. I have to do enclosure design for some of my products. And so enclosure design used to involve getting a factory that would do the injection mold design, and that would be maybe $30,000 or $40,000. And sometimes it didn't go right, and you'd have to start all over again. And it would get very, very expensive. With 3D printing, however, I can 3D print multiple versions for like pennies a piece, and it takes a couple hours, but I get a sense of what the shape and design is going to be. Instead of going out and spending $30,000, I now spend 30 cents. I mean, this is orders and orders of magnitude smaller. Anybody who does manufacturing or design or wants to start a company that sells something, they need to get a 3D printer now. It's a requirement because there's no other way to actually do the design. That's where I see this kind of maker technology coming in and actually making a revolution in the way we do industrial manufacture.
And interestingly, I have seen in just the last few months, Amazon open its 3D printing store on its website where people can sort of submit designs for products, get their designs printed out by a 3D printer. What does Amazon's participation here mean to you? I mean, is it an indication that sort of the big guys have gotten in and maybe are trying to own the maker movement as it gets off the ground?
I don't think that the maker movement is just 3D printing. It's so much bigger than that, and that's what makes it beautiful. It is a democracy of people. It is everybody. So I don't think it's going to be like, oh, Amazon took it over, and now it's lame, and like nobody wants to do it anymore. I do think that Amazon's very smart to get into this because maybe what they're doing specifically isn't the future, but they're experimenting with it and they're getting involved in it. They see that there's something there, and oftentimes we don't know necessarily what the disruptive innovation is until it's already passed. But the fact that they're getting in there and dabbling in 3D printing just kind of shows that somebody there is thinking very hard about what the future may be.
Chris Anderson, CEO of 3D Robotics, do you think that in a generation it is going to be normal to go on a website, be able to design your own stuff or buy things from a maker? And that's going to be something that not a very few people do, not a you know, 2%, 5% sliver of the country, but that's something that is a sort of normal way of acquiring goods and services.
Absolutely. And in many ways, I think we're already there. I mean, Etsy is a very popular marketplace for what I would call essentially maker goods. Kickstarter is a multi-billion-dollar marketplace as well. Many of these products are available on Amazon. You just don't know that they came from the maker movement. I'm wearing a Pebble smartwatch right now, which again came out of the maker movement. It's the best-selling smartwatch in the world, beat out the Sonys and the Samsungs. We'll see about Apple. So I think that as the maker movement expands, you don't even realize that it's the maker movement. I mean, today I run an aerospace company. We sell drones. We own factories. I started in the maker movement, but today we look like a regular technology company selling in through regular channels. And so I think that as the maker movement becomes more successful, the commercial side of it almost disappears because it just merges right into the economy that we already know, and all you as a consumer recognize is that products got better, faster, and cheaper.
Well, it's interesting that you say you're wearing this Pebble smartwatch right now, which was obviously this huge hit on Kickstarter. And when you talk about how successful it was in terms of okay, it actually did better than Samsung, some of these really big companies and their smartwatches. You know, let me go back to that question of, does this mean then that really big companies have to be concerned that just because they're big doesn't mean that they're going to have the winning products?
Yeah, I think that we have historical precedents. Let's take the media industry that we all know very well. I used to be in the media industry, and owning the means of production, meaning the printing plant or the broadcast towers, gave you essentially a, you know, oligopoly. There weren't many people who could do that, and so big companies dominated the public discourse. Then along came the web, and everyone had the ability to reach the world, in text or images or voice. Now, we still have Hollywood. You know, we're still having this conversation. We still have radio. People still love it. It didn't kill big media, but it just killed the monopoly of big media. And so as a result, I think, you know, great media companies evolved to use these new methods. Some media companies were not able to evolve. Newspapers in particular, you know, struggled against Craigslist. And the consumers, meanwhile, were incredibly well served by having so much more choice. So I think, you know, if you think of it not as a sort of the end of one and the beginning of the other, but rather the end of a monopoly and the beginning of a more vibrant competitive marketplace, then you can see how big companies have the ability to use these maker technologies and maker communities to become better companies so they can serve the new consumer demand.
Lamour Fried, are we going to see maker spaces popping up all over the place, these places where people can say, okay, I want to go build something, but I live in an apartment. I don't have like a wood shop in the back of my house. So I'm going to go to a place that has all these tools, and then I can make this cool thing I have an idea for.
As to the question of whether we will see maker spaces popping up all over the place, I've got some bad news for you. It's too late. They've already infested America. There are hundreds of maker spaces in America. There's probably one like within a couple blocks of your house. So you should go there and check it out. They offer classes and they have workshops and they have events, and they have parties, and it's amazing and it's wonderful and beautiful to see people from all over a neighborhood and a community join together and build projects together, learn how to code, learn how to solder, learn how to use a lathe. There's even commercial workshops like Tech Shop that's open in a couple cities now where you can go and get a membership. It's basically like a gym for making. And, you know, you get access to the coolest tools like water jets and laser cutters and six-axis mills. And it's amazing that in the last only 3 or 4 years, you know, makerspaces and hackerspaces went from maybe only like 10 in America to hundreds. You know, there's easily maybe 4,000 or 5,000 in the world.
You know, we've certainly seen that the maker movement has caught on to a certain degree that maker fairs can attract huge crowds, tens of thousands of people.
Hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands of people.
Hundreds of thousands.
But when you look at those crowds, I wonder if you think that it's not diverse enough, that maybe there are not enough women, that there are not enough minorities in those crowds, that this is still a movement that's appealing to a narrow slice of the pie.
I think that the first group of people, I mean, always is going to be people who have a little bit more money because it is expensive to get some of these tools. However, with places like makerspaces and hackerspaces, especially after-school programs like FIRST that are open in, you know, almost any high school now, the group of people that is joining is becoming more diverse. I'm seeing many more people from, you know, all sorts of towns, all sorts of backgrounds. You know, we have like Fab Labs, we have makerspaces, we have FIRST Robotics, we have maker fairs. When we have maker fairs in all these different towns as well, and they're usually just the community. I've been part of many, you know, groups that would be considered technology groups, you know, like people who hack Linux or people who are ham radios or people who like to write code or people who like to game. And I think that the maker community by far is the most inclusive that I've been in. What's really nice is, like Chris Anderson said, it's not just people who like computers. You can like computers, that's fine. But it's also people who like to cook, who like to craft, who like to sew, who like to crochet, who like to do cosplay, who like to use their hands in any way, and people bringing that technology together. So now we're seeing a lot of cosplayers hanging out with electronics geeks to make electronics costumes. I mean, this is so cool. Like, isn't this the point of the maker movement? I think so.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one more group, which is kids. That's one of the things I love about Maker Faires, is just how many kids you see there and how accessible it is to kids. The tactile elements, the fact that you can engage with anything from to wood to plastics to electronics to fabrics and plants, there's something for everybody. And I think of the next makerspace as being not just the ones that Lamour talked about, but also schools. The fact that this is starting to get woven into the curriculum. When I was a kid, we had industrial arts and workshop, and there was something called home economics as well. And those all got wiped out in the 70s with budget cuts. And as a result, there was an entire generation that was kind of lost the art of making things. And now it's coming back in, but via the computer lab. It starts digital, so it resonates with the kids, but then ends up physical, so they have that real tactile engagement. So I think that I've never seen a technology movement as inclusive across generations as this one.
Chris Anderson is the former editor at Wired Magazine. He's the author of Makers, The New Industrial Revolution, and he's the co-founder and CEO of 3D Robotics. And Lamour Fried is the founder of Adafruit Industries, an online maker supplier. Chris, Lamour, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.